No, thank you. Thanks.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. Microphone's working? I can hear it now.
Yes.
Good. Okay. All right. Well, take a seat, get your waters, get your refreshments, and then come back and join us. We're going to be talking about Cancer Moonshot for the next hour. My name is Mary Stober Murray. I'm the VP of Collaborative Action Networks at NMQF, and I'm the chair of our Cancer Working Group. So before we get fully started, I just want to, you guys, this is a panel like many of the other panels. Each person will go and make an opening statement, and then we'll have a moderated Q&A and also some time for audience Q&A. So just make sure, looking for where the microphones are. If you've got a question, make sure I can see you so that we can get your question answered. But we really are excited to talk today about Cancer Moonshot. One adjustment to the program is that we were hoping to have Danielle Carnevale, the White House Moonshot Coordinator, here to join us today, but unfortunately, she couldn't make it. But we still have a very esteemed panel, and I'm very excited to get right to them so that you can hear their great expertise and insights. A little bit of background. The first Cancer Moonshot was announced, I believe it was 2016, by then Vice President Biden. And it had a lot of bold goals, right, around research priorities, sort of getting everyone together around research priorities, cancer care, and outcomes. What it didn't have, what it lacked, was any language around equity. Fast forward to, well, so I should say, because of that kind of lack of overt goal around equity, the Cancer Working Group at NMQF was born. Now we can fast forward 5 years. We have a very active and growing Cancer Working Group with lots of publications and deliverables that have shined a light on many of the issues of cancer care disparities, but also ways to address them, highlighting best practices, et cetera. And now we're really fortunate this year to have a new Cancer Moonshot announced from President Biden. And now there's equity baked throughout all of the goals. So that's what we're going to be exploring today. What are the goals and opportunities associated with the new Cancer Moonshot and opportunities for equity in cancer care and outcomes, and including research in there as well? So I'm very excited to introduce our panelists. Each panelist will, I'll introduce each panelist in order and let them say their opening statements. So we're going to start with Dr. Lee Beamer from the Association of Community Cancer Centers.
Thanks so much, Mary. Appreciate it. Good afternoon to everyone here, and potentially good morning on the West Coast for some of our remote listeners and attendees. I am the Chief Medical Officer for ACCC, which is the association that Mary had mentioned, and we are the leading education and advocacy organization for the entire continuum of the cancer care team. And so we've got about 2,100 cancer programs and practices across the United States, and within them, roughly 30,000 interdisciplinary healthcare professionals that make up that team. And I think that's really important that we start there and we keep our thoughts focused there as we talk about community all throughout the day. So in our membership, we've, of course, got the physicians, the MDs, and the DOs, but we've also got social workers and pharmacists and front desk receptionists and laboratory technicians. And it's really about the interface and exchange of the team and the representation of folks on the team from throughout the community when we broaden our membership beyond just the traditional physicians within the cancer centers. Amongst our strategic priorities at ACCC, we count really important pillars relative to the Moonshot, like leveraging digital health and patient-reported outcomes, certainly equity, diversity, and inclusion, and we do so through the lens of things like oncology practice transformation, cancer diagnostics, precision medicine, capacity building for community oncology research teams. And again, we've heard so much of this earlier today, so I'm really excited to continue the discussion in the context of the entire cancer care spectrum. And I guess I'll just also mention, trust building, identification of cultural competencies and realization of cultural norms, implicit bias training, and many other resources that you can read about through the summit materials that were shared with you about ACCC and our ongoing projects. I will end with a mention that I'm also coming to the stage today as a cancer survivor myself of metastatic testicular. Next month will be 20 years. So I also have the, thanks, thank God. I have the perspective of a cancer patient as well. So back to you, Mary.
Thank you so much, Lee. And now I'd like to introduce Veronica Sandoval, who's the Principal of Patient Inclusion and Health Equity in the Chief Diversity Office at Genentech.
Thank you, Mary. Well, again, thank you for inviting us and allowing us to be part of this panel. You know, when I was told by Mary, you know, prepare 3 minutes of an introduction, I was like, where do I start? You know, I would love to tell you everything that we're doing at Genentech, but I will not do that to you, I promise. You know, the one thing that I really, though, do want to stress, you know, being part of the Chief Diversity Office, we are really committed at Genentech in trying to advance health equity. You know, and you've heard from different panels, how do you even define health equity? Where do you start, right? And being part of the first cancer moonshot, you know, and trying to know, we know that there's early diagnosis is important. We know that access to medications are important. We know that clinical trial diversity is also important. And knowing that as an industry, we actually touch all of those areas. And, you know, having the second chance of making another difference and hopefully decrease the barriers that patients face when you talk about early diagnosis. You've heard in the last panel that policy is important. You know, and I just want to share one area, right? And if there's anything that you leave and say, you know, what is Genentech working on? I hope that you remember this because it's, you know, we're really building a partnership with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, or ACS-CAN. And with ACS-CAN, they're really pioneering in working at the state level. And they're trying to figure out, well, how do we advance biomarker testing? And why is biomarker testing important? Because if we could really figure out what cancers our patients are having, then we could truly deliver equitable health care, because we're bringing the care to the patients. We're giving the patients a voice in saying, this is what my cancer is, treat me with the right medication. Genentech is known for our oncology work and footprint in the industry. And we truly want to develop those personalized health medicines that patients receive at the time that they needed. And ACS-CAN is helping advance that. So building those partnerships, again, because Genentech cannot do this on our own. We really need to partner. And that is a theme of community that I think NMQF is really bringing forward. And we are proud to have partnerships like with NMQF, ACS-CAN, and others in order to advance health equity for all of our patients. Now back to you, Mary.
Thank you so much, Veronica. Now I'd like to introduce to you Ricky Fairley, who's the CEO of TOUCH, the Black Breast Cancer Alliance.
Good afternoon. I'm so grateful to be here with this illustrious panel of brainiacs. So thank you so much for this opportunity. So I'm a 10-year survivor of triple negative breast cancer. I was diagnosed at stage 3A, and I did a double mastectomy, a lot of chemo, a lot of radiation, and my cancer came back a year later, almost to the day of my diagnosis, and my doctor said, I don't have anything for you, you have 2 years to live, get your affairs in order. And I said, well, I can't really die right now because I have a daughter at Dartmouth, I have to pay for her tuition, so me, you, and God and some drugs or something have to work this out. And I reached out to the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation at the time, and there were three things on Google for triple negative at the time. You're gonna die, and call the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation. So I did. They found me a doctor. There were probably one of about five doctors at the time that were exploring clinical, you know, research for triple negative breast cancer. And she put me on some experimental drugs, and I'm still here. So 10 years later. So I know that God left me here to do this work, and I feel convicted every day about why I'm here, and I'm very grateful to do this work. I started my foundation a couple of years ago because as I started to dig through the data, and I'm a marketing person by trade, not a scientist or a doctor, but I put together a PowerPoint presentation that really was a surprise to a lot of people in the ecosystem, but I kind of looked at it like a marketing analysis. And what I learned was that Black women have a 41% higher mortality rate than white women. Black women survivors have a 39% higher rate of recurrence than white women. Black women like me who've had breast cancer have a 71% relative rate of death than white women. Black women under 35 get breast cancer at twice the rate of white women, die at three times the rate of white women, well before they would have that first mammogram at age 40. Black women at under age 50 die at twice the rate of white women. So why is this happening? And I said, there's got to be something. And is it genetic? Is it, what is it? What's happening? I started digging into it. And when I looked at the science, if you look back and when a lot of the drugs were made 20 and 30 years ago, 10 years ago, Herceptin 17 years ago, guess what? There were no Black women in those clinical trials. And so the drugs that we have were never tested on Black bodies. So if you think about it, for every 100 white women that die of breast cancer, 141 Black women die. So something is wrong with the science. And there's now a growing body of data to validate that, yes, Black breast cancer is a different disease on a cellular basis. And it's happening across the country, and a lot of scientists are digging into this to identify, you know, that we need a different standard of care. We need a Black standard of care for Black breast cancer. And so our purpose of my foundation is to eradicate Black breast cancer. I don't know that I can cure it in my lifetime, but I at least want to get mortality rate parity for Black women. I work every day for my three grandchildren. They're 4.5, 2.5, and 1. And I don't want them to ever use these words and talk about this horrible disease. And so a couple of weeks ago, we were in the shower with the two older daughters, and the 4.5-year-old said, my grandma name is Debbie. So Debbie, how come you don't have those things on your boobs that baby heart sucks on? Because her mom is nursing her baby sister. And so we had a long conversation, our first real conversation about breast cancer and what it looks like and what happened to me and what I went through. And at 4.5, she digested it very well, but it made me think about, I don't want her to talk about this. We have a lot of work to do to advance the science. And we recently started a movement called When We Trial. If you go to whenwetrial.org, and I'll speak more about this later, but I did a research study last year and I interviewed 300 Black breasties. And what I learned from my research was that clearly all of the things that you think are happening with clinical trial, you know, about the earned medical mistrust, and you know, we talked about mistrust earlier today, that's all in place. But was a lot of what's driving the fear of clinical trial participation is a lack of understanding and the literacy level of how a clinical trial works, what standard of care is, what how the science happens, is really just non-existent in our community. And the voice of trust in our community is a breastie. We don't trust the doctors, we don't trust pharmaceutical companies, we don't trust the clinicians, but we trust each other. And if a breastie says, like me says, you know, don't do the clinical trial, you're gonna get the sugar pill and die, I believe it. And that's what's happening in our community. So I had to figure out how I can undo that knowledge or that lack of knowledge, educate Black women about what a clinical trial is all about, and then also teach them how to advocate for themselves and ask for the care they deserve. And so right now they're not being asked to participate in trials. And so the work that we're doing is to educate but also teach them how to say, I need better care. So we'll speak more later, so thank you.
Thank you, Ricky. And now I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Liz Valencia. She's a practicing radiation oncologist, but also Associate Dean of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine.
Thank you, everyone. I will just take a moment to tell you a little bit about my story in hopes that my experience will connect with some of you and that you might hear what I want to share. And what I want to share is behalf of many community members, patients, students, faculties, colleagues, everyone in the game that's trying to make a difference. So I'm Mexican. I'm first generation Chicana. My parents are migrant workers to this country. My whole life, I moved every 3 to 6 months, depending on the crop season. So we started in Eastern Washington, Oregon, Southern California, Texas, Florida, Tennessee, New York, Illinois, the whole circuit all over again. And this was normal to me. This is my community, my barrio, and we helped each other, but we didn't have access to a lot of things. And we were very aware of that. I remember being about 5 years old when I started to translate for the migrant worker camps. And then even as I got to maybe 8, 9, 10, that I would translate at the public health department, and there would be families ahead of us in line, and they would ask a question and the answer was yes. And then I would step up with whoever I was translating for from my migrant worker camp, and I would ask the same exact question and we got no. And I remember being a kid saying, "But why?" And then they would tell me, "Because." And I would say, "Well, where does it say that? Show us, because surely, you know, this is a mistake. Teach us, tell me, like, how do we need help. We're here because we need help. How do we pass go? What is it about us that doesn't allow us to have access?" And so from a very young age, I knew that there was something that I needed to learn, a skill set to navigate. There were words I had to use. I had to organize. I had to study the problem. And I always committed to finding out and coming back to my barrio. I always committed to figuring out what it was that my community needed to be able to have a chance. We call this word equity. We say equity. But what we really want is an equal opportunity to have a chance. We want a chance. We want a chance at health. We want a chance to live our lives with our families. We want a chance to be able to engage. We want a chance to lead, not just be in the room, but have a voice, and not just have a voice, but to be leadership, to create and drive the change that we in our communities know we need. And so that started my journey into wanting to pursue medicine, because I wanted to be a healer. I was like, "I'm gonna go figure this stuff out and come back, because health is so important. Like, we can't even begin to live life without an opportunity to be well. It's so challenging." I saw my community suffer. And so when I went to medical school, I decided that I needed to learn another skill set. And at the time, I was thinking MPH, MBA, and I ran across what's called an MD-JD program, which is a dual degree in law and medicine, and I committed to doing that. I went and went to law school first. I worked for two governors, senior cabinet in the state of Illinois. For public health and human services, I covered Department of Public Aid, Child and Family Services, and also a Department of Public Health. And I did that for about a year, and then also worked in the legislative council for the governor. Those experiences were critical because I was so used to being on the front lines, driving change, working hand in hand, side by side with community members, making it happen. But I also needed to learn how to partner. I needed to learn how to partner with those in leadership, those creating the governance and policy that drove resources, that drove programs, that drove what the platform would be for our county, for our state, and for our region, and even nationally. And that was a difficult transition for me, but it was so important that I learned how to do that, because then I could sit back and see, okay, these are the conversations we need to have. These are the connections. This is where we intersect, and these are my partners. And so knowing that we're stronger together was such a critical part of my journey. And then from there, I went to med school. I ended up going into radiology to treat breast cancer. And that's what my fellowship is in. And in med school, I had an experience with my best friend at the time, Janaea Carter. We were 6 months from graduating med school, and we were on our surgery rotation. And I ran into her in the cafeteria, and she said to me, "Lizzie, I have a lump." And I remember thinking, "Oh yeah, sure, fiber adenoma, a cyst." She said she had a breast lump, so I'm thinking benign things. And she said, "No, I had it biopsied, it's cancer." And I remember thinking the whole room stopped, you know, it was just, everything stopped. And I said, okay, we can fix this. We're young. We're like in our early 30s. We got this, you know, early detection. We're going to figure this out. I went with her through all her surgeries and treatments. I was in the OR when the pathologist was doing frozen section and was like, the third lymph node is positive, the fifth, the sixth, the seventh. And I remember being in there thinking, how did this happen? Like, how can it be that advanced? Like, we just found it like 3 weeks ago. How is this possible? And I went with her. She did double, it was a triple negative breast cancer. I went with her through all her treatment. She had bilateral mastectomies with reconstruction. She had radiation treatment. She had chemo. We graduated together. I went to Arizona for radiology. She went to MD Anderson to start her surgery residency. And a few months into residency, I got a call that she had passed out in the OR, and they staged her, and it was now metastatic, involving nearly every organ. Her liver was completely replaced, her lungs, it was in her brain and spine and bones. And I flew out there that day. I remember I was a resident, and I just went to my chiefs and like, I have to go, you know, I have family that's, I have to go, and they covered me. And I went to see her, and she looked at me and she was like, Lizzie, I'm going to beat this. This is breast cancer. We know how to treat this. I'm going to beat this. And she ended up passing from her breast cancer a couple weeks later. And it really impacted me. It impacted me that I went and studied so that I could be a breast cancer oncologist in terms of that I do imaging and intervention. But here's the thing. That was like maybe 15 years ago. Fast forward, if it were today, she might still be with us. Because now what we have learned is, as you were saying, Ricky, that we have to talk and screen sooner. Starting at 40, we're behind. It's just not enough. We know that women of color are dying before they even get to 40. We have to screen at an earlier age. And I think, like, if Janae were here, if we were in med school, if I could say, like, fast forward and we were med students now, we would both have had screening assessments, risk assessments at the age of 30, and they would have found out that she was high risk, and she would have been sent for a screening mammogram, and we could have caught that triple negative cancer before it had metastasized to her axilla and the rest of her organs distantly. But we didn't know that then. But now that we know to do better, we have to work together to save more lives. Now that we know better, it's not just breast cancer, it's all the other cancers. And it's not just cancer, it's equity. So now that we know better from the pandemic and everything that we've learned the last couple of years, the game has changed. And this is our opportunity to bring equality. This is our opportunity to partner and to do better and to be stronger together. And so I'll just end with this. I have the opportunity to serve as a Dean of Diversity, Equity, Inclusion at Mayo Clinic, Alex School of Medicine, three campuses, Jacksonville, Scottsdale, Rochester. And I want you to know that I'm here because of the students. The students, the generation of physicians going to medicine, this is their priority. They're all about this. We have a generation of healthcare workers. We have a workforce that said, we start here. We start with health equity, and then we go forward. Then we learn medicine. It's a generation that wants to serve. It's a generation that wants solutions now. And so I'm in this position because they have stood up and said, this is our message. This is our voice. You go, Dr. Valencia, and you let them know. You let them know what we're committing to. You let them know what we're looking for residency and GME. You let them know we want to be at the table for policy and leadership. And that's why I'm here. I'm here for them. I'm here for the patients. I'm here for Janaea, and I'm here for the faculty in the room that are holding it down. You know who you are, and we can't do this without you. I see you, and I appreciate you, and I appreciate that y'all are including us in the conversation. It's a game changer. And so thank you, everyone. And I hope to share more of our work and our story throughout the conversation today.
So I think it'd be really hard to follow all this, and I want to keep everyone on time. Just to start off, I'm Bilal Pipuri. I'm a VP of Clinical Development. I think some of you saw me a little earlier on the stage, getting a prize for the Gilead. Just a little bit of my background quickly. I'm a thoracic oncologist by training. I was in academia like you before. I practiced for many years. And my practice was actually in Bronx at Montefiore. So I do, know how cancer disproportionately affects minorities and people who are marginalized. But one more important thing with the cancer is, it affects almost everyone. I just want to maybe have an audience involved and maybe you raise your hands if you know someone who have cancer or someone who have survived cancer or deal with it. I just want to see it.
Everybody.
See, almost everyone.
Yeah, everybody.
I mean, that's a reality. I mean, I've been in oncology, I've treated, never thought I'd have to deal with it. My dad was diagnosed with metastatic kidney cancer about 2 years ago. Knock on the wood, he's doing pretty well with all the, modern treatment with immunotherapy and stuff. One thing I really start to realize, taking care of him and getting through it on the micro basis, on the individual patient level basis, patients really go through a lot to get to what you need, and you need a very strong advocate that's advocating for you to navigate through the system. And when you talk about the equity and the healthcare, and when I practice the thing, it's getting access to those treatment. As you said, the science has moved on. I mean, the treatment for cancers are not what you used to have 15, 20 years ago. So trying to get that effective treatment for triple negative breast cancer, for bladder cancer, for kidney cancer, really trying to get it to the individual patient level is what we're going to really need if we're going to make the promises and the difference that we want to do it on the moonshot. So I'm really pleased to be here with all of you on the stage. I'm going to keep it short. It really has to be a partnership. I know we offer, it's really no distinction. I mean, we all transition from one role to another. It's academia, it's the industry, it's the patients, it's the advocates. We all are in together because we want, put the cancer to a history. So I think we're going to talk a lot about, diagnosis, early diagnosis, prevention, which is great. I mean, how we can tailor based on this. But well, I think, as a researcher, as a drug developer, what's also is really critical is to recognize how far we have come with some of these treatments. And as I mentioned in my speech earlier, those treatments are only going to make a difference if we all make sure that those treatments reach to the patients in most need. And I think that's what we are all here for. And I think it really requires a very strong partnership across all the organizations to really try to get that delivered. So I'll stop there and maybe give you some time back.
We're good. We're right on time. But honestly, let's use our minute to say, what a panel, right? We're so excited to have all of you here with us. So thank you all, and thank you all for sharing your insights. So let's bring it back again to sort of cancer moonshot. And we know that, once again, we've got bold goals in cancer moonshot to help ensure that everyone in the United States equitably benefits from cancer care. So I want to sort of, we talked about equity being baked through all of the goals, so I'll mention a couple of the goals and then ask our panelists to show, to help us think about equity in those contexts. So first to Lee, I'd like to ask you to address the goal, sort of the mathematical goal, right? To reduce cancer deaths by half. How should we be thinking about this kind of beyond the math? And really be thoughtful so that we don't inadvertently worsen disparities. What are we at risk to do if we don't think this through?
I appreciate the question, Mary, and I'd love to hear others' thoughts on this as well, but to expand on this analogy of baking a cake, maybe. Seriously, it's every single one of us in this room who brings an ingredient to bake that cake, right? So it's about research and drug design and investigational therapeutics, and through the lens of equity, diversity, inclusion, how are we equitably distributing those resources? We have a wonderful example that was brought up earlier around precision therapeutics, biomarker testing. That was supposed to be, can still be, the future of the elusive cure for cancer and or targeted therapeutics to extend lives for patients with cancer. And yet it's very imprecisely still today delivered. And we know that people who are eligible according to guidelines and current practice standards for biomarker testing aren't getting them. And so as I think about, you know, a reduction in cancer death rates by 50%, greater than or equal to, over the next 25 years, concurrent with an improvement in the lives of patients and caregivers and family members dealing with this illness, it has got to be about activating equitable distribution of current technologies and new innovative technologies and therapies as we do so, and making sure that, because I'm a numbers guy, so I have to say a little bit of numbers, right? We're not achieving 50% reduction in cancer deaths only by interventions designed for majority patients with the top three cancers, right? Breast, lung, and colorectal. We need to make sure that it's also inclusive of rural patients, older adults with cancer, individuals who suffer from rare cancers and or benign conditions that are precursors or increased likelihood for cancer development over time. And it needs to be representative and take place in the primary care environments for the majority of patients in the United States with cancer, which is to say, in community oncology programs and practices across the country, where greater than 80 to 85%, depending upon the reference that you're looking at, of care is provided along a patient with cancer's journey. The other thing that I want to say is, you know, I have great, great respect, as we've already identified, for the education and the foundational knowledge and the research that happens in academic and NCI and large, large comprehensive community cancer programs. But I really believe that real world evidence and foundational experience and not just the phase one, two types of clinical trial work that goes on, but, you know, the comparative research and the real life registries, et cetera, which can happen in community programs, needs to happen in community programs so that we can talk about effective best practices and talk about translatable solutions to things like inequitable cancer care distribution and resources. So I laud the administration's emphasis on a reduction in cancer death and through the lens of equity and with an eye towards an improved patient experience, but let's learn from what we already know to be true in precision medicine and biomarkers and make sure that from day one here in this room, we are talking about baking a cake with equity at the heart, using all the stakeholders who are here, and let's not make the same mistakes again and make sure everybody is represented as we go for that reduction in cancer death rates.
Thank you, Lee. You've given us a lot of different points to touch on. One of them you talked about was kind of drug development and having more inclusive research, and that's exactly what Genentech has been working on very diligently for the past several years. And so I wonder, Veronica, if you could describe for our audience the Advancing Inclusive Research Site Alliance and how that starts to address some of the points that Lee just brought up.
Lee, thank you for sitting me up right here. Yeah, and the Advancing Inclusive Research Site Alliance, you know, it's one of its kind initiative that, and it's an innovative initiative that Genentech actually launched last year. So it's still in its early infancy stages. You know, we're learning a lot from it. It's a pilot program that we started with four oncology centers across the U.S. We're, of course, being a California company, we have City of Hope in L.A., we also have Mace Cancer Center in San Antonio, the West Cancer Center in Memphis, Tennessee, and the University of Alabama, Birmingham. What the reason that all of these sites were chosen, you know, was because there was data that we had internally, data that we looked at, that showed that these sites, and to Nee's point, right, we have to go where the community is. These four oncology centers have proven that not only are they good at running oncology studies, but they're good at reaching to the community, recruiting patients of color. You know, we heard from Ricky how important it is for medications to actually be studied in those populations, right? And what we're trying to learn, and to Mary's point, is best practices, right? And the unique of the Site Alliance is that we're truly going to where the experts are, trying to learn from them. What is it that you're doing? Why are you so successful that we could take those best practices and share them with the rest of our oncology sites? And even more so, what we are doing with these oncology centers is that truly we are co-partnering and co-creating with them. We have, you know, access to the best minds, that we actually have a diversity and inclusion council that was developed, that was started with these four oncology centers, that we come to them with our protocols. We know that our protocols must have that inclusion and diversity lens. Part of Genentech's 2025 commitments is that we have an advancing inclusive research health equity pillar. And we want all of our molecule teams to have diversity and inclusion plans from the get-go. And that's where we are bringing this SAT Alliance to really hold us accountable and say, look, these are our protocols. Let's bring those patients to the table, the investigators, right? And tell us, does these inclusion and exclusion criteria make sense? You know, I know that when there's, you know, a famous cartoon that actually has a pharmacist, you know, give dispensing medication, but then he says, wait, there's like all of these inclusion and exclusion criteria, over 1,000, right? And that's what we have to do. We cannot have 1,000 inclusion and exclusion criteria. We really need to make protocols be reflective of that community so we could bring and recruit patients of color. And that's what the Site Alliance is helping us to do. Right. And, you know, in addition to just learning from them, you know, we understand, and Liz touched, you know, a little bit to this, you know, being a Latina, I still remember, also very similar to Liz, you know, I went to my mother when I was with my mom at 6 years old, interpreting my mother with the physician, right? Again, you're relying on a 6-7-year-old to translate the medical issues. You know, let's just, you know, have that sit, because that's not right, right? We know that that's not equitable healthcare. And when we're thinking about how do we address the community and how do we leverage all of these experts, that at this Site Alliance is really co-creating material that reflects and is culturally sensitive to those patients. We're talking about clinical trials. We're talking about access to medical care. So at Genentech, what we did, we actually partnered with our MACE Cancer Center, because they have a large Spanish-speaking population, and we also have Spanish-speaking providers. Let's create a video to educate on what a clinical trial is, both in Spanish and in English. So all sites beyond oncology can truly play this video and say, this is what a clinical trial is, and start breaking those barriers, right? If we truly want to have early access, early treatments, it needs to start with that education, and we need to co-create. Everyone has to have a seat on the table, right? So it is, you know, I'm very passionate. We could talk for the rest of the 20 minutes about what the Site Alliance looks like and what we have accomplished, but it is truly the main message for you to remember is we need to work with those experts and have the expertise in working in oncology, but most importantly, working with the community, and who are willing to really help us and be transparent with industry. You know, those protocols are really not inclusive and keep us all accountable. Back to you, Mary.
So thank you, Veronica, but I see Ricky, and I was gonna ask you anyway, so no, jumping at the bit, jump in.
It boils down to you're in a room, you're having a paper gown, and your doctor tells you you have cancer. So that conversation between the patient and the doctor. And health equity starts with what I call cultural humility. And it's what my mother taught me. My mom's her celebrating her 89th birthday today. She's here with me. But it's what my mother taught me. You know, it's the golden rule. It's I want treat people how you want to be treated. And health equity isn't going to happen until every provider in whatever their job is treats their patient how they want to be treated, how they would treat their mom or their grandma or their auntie or their daughter. And it's as basic as that. It's as basic as being a human being, treating another person with you know, with love. And that's what health is all about. So all the structure around everything we're talking about, whether it's how a trial is set up and how the science advances and what the chemicals are or whatever, what the DNA is, it starts with love. It starts with somebody caring about another person and doing the right thing by them. And that's what I ask my patients to demand from their doctors. I want to be treated how you would treat your mom. I want to be treated how you would expect to be treated as a doctor. And I think we have to start there and build everything else around that and build the structures around that. And if you think about like all these, everybody's talking about D&I and they're you know, doing all these like D&I training for doctors and training for the industry. Who wrote the training materials? Somebody who isn't racist or has implicit bias, right? And so I think it's got to be broken down to the human level. And, you know, a person talking to a person about their life and caring about their life.
Please, Liz.
Is my mic on? So 2 points. And I love where the conversation's going. I love the part about community education. I just want to be intentional about putting at the center of the table is relationships. And we say trust building, but relationships. To think that we can walk into a community and start educating, and this is a conversation, a dialogue that we have with our community partnerships, with students, with trainees all the time. To think we can walk in and just start educating. How are you gonna educate someone when you don't even know them? You don't even know what their experience is, what their resources are. We have to start with a relationship. We have to start with trusting to lean in and say, what does your community need? What can we do differently? What gap, where do we bridge the gaps? Maybe we start with sorry. Maybe we start with an apology and we start over, but together, because without the leadership from the communities that we're trying to serve, we are just spinning our wheels. We need partnership, true partnership. At the table needs to be the leaders of the communities that we're trying to reach and engage. And they need to not just be at the table, they need to have a voice. And I need to learn from them. I need to say, tell me, what do I need to do? Teach me, let me serve. How does my organization, how do our students, how do we come in? How do we, then at some point we can talk perhaps about what clinical trials are. Maybe we talk about the advisory boards. Maybe those things become more normalized. But I just wanted to just prioritize that having a relationship in is necessary for there to be trust and there for there to be education and engagement. And I think so many times we're so wanting as physicians or providers or anyone involved in this equity work trying to just bring solutions that we want to skip that part. But I've heard often that sometimes we need to go slow to go fast. So sometimes we need to like build it right. We need to fertilize it. And we need to allow for some organic, authentic relationship building. And the second thing I wanted to share was in terms of being able to have equity with trainees and students. I think our healthcare infrastructure needs to change their values, needs to prioritize the value of creating this relationship, needs to prioritize the metric of what equity in DEI is in medicine. Because we're not judged by those metrics. We're judged by how many patients you see in an hour, how many biopsies are you recommending, how much of this and that. It's a volume based, it's not quality. It's not quality based. And so now here we are trying to embed and incorporate principles of equity, but yet our infrastructure doesn't value or prioritize that yet. And so that's why I'm really thankful for the thought leaders here that are policy, government, state, nonprofit, who are at those tables saying, no, 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 let's look at how we do remuneration in healthcare in this country. This is where our, this is the direction we're headed in, and these are the adjustments that need to be done now to build it right.
Thank you, Liz. Hola.
Yeah, I'm just going to, I mean, it's a great conversation. I'm just going to chime in. We need more people like you. So I think I'm just going to take it to another level, is that, you know, in a healthcare industry and also like in a clinical trials, people who do the clinical trials, we need minorities. We need minority doctors. We need people who speak the same language. That's what's towards the end that's going to really make a difference, because a lot of time, at multiple level, at the clinical trial level, at the patient navigator level, it's really critical that people who are actually doing it on the ground actually share the same culture, speak the same language, and understand the issues that are out there. So this last year, we, as a Gilead, we participate with the, you know, Bristol-Myers Squibb Foundation. We announced at the AACR. We are sponsoring multi-year you know, fellowship and training for young investigators of different backgrounds to do clinical research and, you know, be more involved with the clinical trials and get involved with it. As much as it's important to change some of the eligibility criteria, you really need to get the forces on the ground to actually to do the job and get, you know, more folks involved in the clinical trial. I'm not as good as Lee with the numbers, so I need to write some things down. Yeah, but you know, last year alone at Gilead, you know, we donated about $9 million in grant funding, and over half of it, $4.1 million, is to 18 organizations to help bridge that gap in barriers in the triple negative breast cancer. You know, there are many organizations that we supported throughout. Yeah, you could have a wonderful drug. I mean, there are multiple wonderful drugs that are coming out, but unless that's really reaching out to the community that are mostly highly impacted and they know how to ask to the doctors about this, we're not going to make a difference to get these, you know, drugs to their patients. So it's really critical that we all do this collectively, and more importantly for me, do it more purposefully, that what's going to make a dent in terms of the outcome, in terms of the equity.
Thank you all. And you sort of, we've gone a little bit off, not our script, but our, a little bit off our plan, but we still covered all the topics, because what you've just been talking about is the oncology workforce and the future of the oncology workforce. And we know that that is also one of the goals of Cancer Moonshot, to make investments in the oncology workforce. I'm just looking for the exact term they use, a Cancer Moonshot Scholars Program, to invest in the next generation of diverse, innovative cancer researchers as part of the relaunch. So I want to stick with that for a minute, because the other, so what I heard you say, Liz, was these young folks, these young students in medical school, future researchers, future clinicians, they are ready now to start with equity. But that sounds to me, I'm not a education person, but that sounds to me like a big change in curriculum. And even what you were talking about, Bilal, that also sounds like a big change in thinking about preparing the workforce. And so can we make such big changes and not expect pushback? Where is the pushback going to come from? This wasn't a prepared question. I think the only person I had talked about this before the meeting was with Liz, but I want to give you all a chance to think about that. How do you advocate for these kind of bold changes and restructuring of priorities and metrics within your respective institutions and systems that you're engaging with? So I could start with Bilal if you're ready, or we can work our way back this way.
Again, as I said, it really has to be purposeful. I mean, you know, I mean, from our perspective, you know, with the clinical trials that we're doing, I mean, you know, you got to be purposeful to get appropriate representation of the patients that are representing that disease state. I know it's quite challenging, but, you know, as you're saying, unless we do it purposefully, we're not going to do, I mean, it's not going to happen. I think very importantly, I think someone mentioned on the panel, I think developing a trust is very important. I mean, people understanding, you know, the most latest therapies, you know, the effective therapies are being offered on the clinical trials. I mean, it's very important to get that trust, you know, get out into the community, people understand this. Maybe I'll pass it over to Ricky.
She's yeah, Ricky's ready.
Yeah.
Trust is going to come from patients, right? It has to be earned, and it has to be the calls I get every day, triple negative people every day. It's horrible. The doctor said X, Y, Z, but Ricky, what do you think? Well, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a scientist, but I can tell you five women that did this, or six women that did this, or these had this experience. And the work that we're doing is we're using the voice of a breastie, the voice of a patient, to educate. So the voice of the doctor doesn't work. They don't want to hear it from a doctor, they don't want to hear it from a clinician. They want to hear it from a patient who's lived it or who's experiencing it now. And I think that's why it's so important to have advocacy as part of this whole conversation, because we're doing the work for everybody, because they're calling us with all the science. Well, can you explain this to me? And a lot of time, I don't know what I'm talking about, but I can find somebody that can help us with this. But I think we have to, and I know that our work is happening. We've had our campaign in place for about a month and a half now, and we've signed up 300 Black women for clinical trials just by reaching out in the community. And we're trying to be where Black women live, work, play, and pray. But it's the voice of the breastie with a message of education. And I know from my experience, I can convince a breastie who's got metastatic triple negative breast cancer in 5 minutes to do a trial by just explaining what it is. Standard of care, you're gonna get better care, you're not gonna get a sugar pill in 5 minutes. It's not that hard, but it's because it's my voice and, you know, or the voice of a patient. I think when you talk about moonshot too, is like, you know, every day with COVID, Dr. Fauci was on TV. He stood at on the screen and he talked about what the numbers were and what the vaccine's all about and whatever. But he was like the voice of God on COVID. We don't have a voice for cancer. Like, to me, all of these things that we're trying to measure, we have all these fiefdoms, everybody working really, really hard, running on their treadmill, trying to do this important work. But who's managing the farm? So when you think about what the metrics of moonshot are, what is that going to look like? Who's saying, okay, here's all the money that we have. Some's going to get spent here, here, and here. As we're all contributing money, we're all spending a lot of money. You guys are spending tons of money and tons of energy and tons of brain power. But who's standing at the top saying, Oz is over there, everybody has on a green hat, and we're going to get there by Friday? Who's doing that? Who's directing the choir? Who's directing the orchestra? You know, right now, we have a lot of really good noise happening because everybody's in their lane playing their music. But when's the music going to come where we're all working together with leadership that's saying, we're going to do this work. We are going to do, you know, achieve cancer, you know, whatever, the 50% by whatever year. But it takes somebody stepping up to say, I'm going to lead this and I'm going to direct it and we're going to work together to make it happen.
Thank you, Ricky. And I'm going to ask Veronica to comment.
I just
one second. I'm just going to ask you to comment, but then also, folks, please start to get ready. If you've got questions, there's a microphone there that I can see really well. I can't see the microphone over here as well. So if you're over there, just speak up if you have a question. But if you want to ask questions, start moving to the microphones, and then sorry to interrupt. But
no, no problem.
Veronica.
I just wanted to add to Ricky's point regarding people want to hear from a patient survivor, cancer survivors, and even those patients that receive that diagnosis. They want someone that looks like them to actually be there explaining this plan. And even to Liz's point, right, when you're talking about those medical students, they're ready. But what we need to do is arm them with the right resources, right? And in addition to that, when we're thinking about all of the, you know, who touches a patient, all of us here, including myself, all of us are patients at one time in our lives, many multiple times, yes. And we're also advocates for our families and ourselves. But even when you're going through that process and that patient journey, and you're trying to find that doctor, that patient navigator, even it comes down to that receptionist that looks like you, speaks your language, that makes you feel like this is a doctor that is going to take care of me. It's, again, that word community, right? Where do we start, even with the cancer moonshot of increasing this access and diversity in workforce? We have to go back all the way to that preschooler, right? Because we need to start, and I think all of us, and even when we had, you know, in the previous panel, you know, talking about the churches, right? How are we leveraging our relationships? How are we really starting educating the next generation of not only future doctors and future scientists, but truly inspiring our next generation to say, I can activate my own health in the community, and the health in my community, because it's going to take everyone to understand and educate themselves and really start saying, I see myself in these roles. You know, when Liz and I came up to the stage, we were so happy. We're like, it's another Latina, right? We started speaking Spanish because we were so happy. You know, that doesn't happen that often.
I'm just going to chime in. So we really need to take that nihilism against cancer away. I mean, I hear that often. I'm sure all of you know, if you introduce yourself, you're an oncologist, the first thing they say, how do you do this? I say, what do you mean, how do you do this, right? I mean, so I think particularly if you talk about, you know, marginalized communities or minorities, it's really critical, I think, we start cultivating that love for research, that love for to get a solution to treat something like cancer, because I think that's what's going to make a difference in terms of the next generation that's coming up. And you know, we've come a long way in terms of the cancer treatment. I mean, you know, nowadays you can give a T-cell infusion and cure some of the patients with lymphoma. You know, you can, all the treatments are getting very sophisticated. We need talented people to come in, but more importantly, those talented people to be passionate about this inclusion and diversity so that we can actually deliver these patients, you know, this treatment to the right patients. So yeah, it's...
And the last thing, and I'll leave you with this, Mary, is there's a lot of experts, there's a lot of representation from industry, there's a lot of examples. You know, if you want to learn what Genentech is doing, you know, there's, we have, you know, our K through careers, our Future Lab signature program, where we actually go to those kindergartners, start inspiring them in South San Francisco, and not only inspire them, but sending scientists that look like them, because that's where it starts. It starts with seeing someone that looks like you, comes from that background. You know, I'm so excited that Liz said, you know, my parents were migrant workers, because my parents were those migrant workers as well. So if we could go and inspire those children and say, it doesn't matter where you start, there is room to for you to dream, and let's dream big, and here are the resources. So we could take anything back to that cancer moonshot is, let's start really earmarking resources for our next generation.
Do we have a question from the audience before I, please?
And Mary, if I could, sorry, I'm over here.
Hi. Okay.
Camille with Accolade again. Thank you all for your discussion on the panel. I kind of have two questions. So for, is it Veronica and Lalau? I love the idea of the site alliance, and you talked about having folks from the community, I'm assuming this is patients and healthcare providers, having input into the protocol. I'm wondering if there's thought from industry around including that community perspective even earlier when you're thinking about the investment decision, what you're going to study, which types of cancers you're going to study, and how many trials you're going to do, and which agents are going to be, you know, part of the pipeline and the clinical development program. Is there thought to move that sooner? And then my second question is more around biomarker testing and precision medicine. Is the way of the future, right? But from a community perspective, I know that there are a lot of patients who are scared. You know, they hear genetic testing, genomic testing, and it has kind of like this negative connotation. So what are we doing to make sure that patients are open to that with the realization that it really could guide their therapy in a more targeted way if they're open to doing biomarker testing?
I can take the latter question. As an MD JD and
former policy work. I think that the innovation is there for the biomarker testing, but the whole framework, the governance, the policy, the privacy, that has yet to catch up with the innovation that we're seeing in medicine in general. And it behooves all of us to have to maintain our fiduciary duty as policymakers and as organizations and institutions to be sure that those two things are working in parallel. We have to be able to explain, and sometimes these conversations are hard to even understand amongst each other as experts, but what is the framework? What is the governance and the policy to protect our patients? Who owns that data? How will it be leveraged? And how is the diversity of that data going to encompass the social determinants of health? Are we just doing the same plays with just a different look and expecting a different outcome? Or are we really going to take that data and use it responsibly and create a new infrastructure to do a plug and play that perpetuates equity at baseline? And so these conversations are critical from a policy standpoint and from organizations like this conference here, where we are challenging each other and we're saying, no, this piece, this governance policy ethics piece, the privacy, the protection for our patients and communities, our communities of color, everyone across the board, this is front and center. We start from here. We build from here. And so that is so critical, and it's something that we're trying to have conversations about in medical education and amongst each other as experts at conferences such as this, and so much more needs to be done, and that's just a whole nother conversation for a different panel, but I really appreciate you bringing that forth.
If I could just really briefly add to that too, you know, it's interesting, we have done surveys, and regardless of the cancer type or the historically minoritized patient population that we're talking to, when we ask individuals who we know, because of claims review, received biomarker testing as a diagnostic or therapeutic intervention for their diagnosis of cancer, the rates of people who understand that they had biomarker testing are abysmal. You can go pull whatever, you know, peer-reviewed published article you want, 28%, 33%, 40%, that's a good day, right? 44% of people who had biomarker testing, which to some extent, whether it was, you know, positive or negative, relatively speaking, informed the selection of targeted therapeutics or lack thereof, knew that they had even been tested, right? That's a problem. That's part of this imprecision of precision medicine. So it's got to be about bi-directionally created and curated resources to describe why we're even doing it, or if we did it, or to have patients inform questions for future patients to say, did I get tested? And if I did, what did you do with that? And then do it again, and do it again. And then the next time they come in, talk to their caregiver or their family member, because one time, two times, three times is not enough. No. And you know, it's so great a question, and so much an integration of everything that we've said. The language around it needs to be different. The way that we approach the conversation can be different. The people we're having the conversation with needs to be more inclusive. Voice. Yeah. So thank you for the question.
Yeah, to address to your first question, and obviously, you know, we're getting more and more having a patient advocacy involved in like a protocol building and how do you design and do it. But what you're really asking for is a next step, even looking at where to go much even broader, which is a great suggestion.
Yeah, you know, and just to follow up on that, when we're thinking about, you know, I mentioned during my presentation that we have this commitment at Genentech, by 2025, all of our molecule teams are going to be thinking about this diversity. That truly goes back, let's bring that earlier, right? Even to those, you know, bench scientists who are thinking about where should we be looking at what targets. But let me remind everyone, even those scientists who are trying to figure out what targets are we going to be thinking about, let's be frank, the data that they have, 90% of that data is of white ancestry. We are still lacking patients of color. We are lacking that genetic data, right? So even all of us at the NIH is building this great repository that they want to hit 1 million patients, you know, diverse patients, and have the genomic data. That's going to take us a while to get there, right? And even it goes to that trust, like who has access to this data? What are you doing with my data? that is going to be, again, it's going to be education. You know what Lee said? It's going to be take a lot of us from industry, right? Industry doesn't, let's call the elephant in the room. I'm from Genentech, but all of us know pharmaceuticals don't are not trusted by our communities, right? It really, we have to work with our, those relationships in the community, our doctors, our medical students, even going, and I'm going to end, I see Brandon, yeah. With the primary care physician doctors, yeah, exactly. Right, in our communities of color who are going and telling our own patients, don't go and be a guinea pig. Let that be tested. Tons of education that needs to happen. But again, as a community, we need to figure out where do we start. But absolutely, earlier the better.
Well, I'm going to, no, I got to let it in because I work for this guy. So, but thank you. And you can all see that there is just, we can go on for a long time about this. And the good news is we do have a cancer working group and we will continue the conversation in the cancer working group and in the other modalities that NMQF has. So I really invite you to join us at all of those opportunities. I'd love you to thank our panelists again for sharing their insights. And I will say that 5 years ago when Moonshot was announced, if there was a panel similar to this, I don't think you would have heard the word apology. I don't think you would have heard the words cultural humility, excuse me, like we've heard today. And I think if that's by introducing equity into every component of Cancer Moonshot and every goal, that's already an accomplishment that's helping us steer the ship in the right way. So I want to thank everyone for your participation here. Please connect with our panelists after. And that's that. Thank you. Thank you to all of you.